So we are looking at chapter 17 of Matthew's Gospel this morning. And in most every translation, it comes right after chapter 16, which Randy covered last week. And chapter 16 was pretty eventful. There was a lot going on there. Here's a quick recap. So we know that Jesus had another little run-in with the Pharisees, the Sadducees. He literally referred to them as an evil and adulterous generation. Because they just kept trying to trip him up. They weren't really going to believe anything that he said. Another sign or miracle wasn't going to prove to them anything. They were just trying to trip him up. So Jesus then warned the disciples not to listen to the teaching of the Jewish leaders. And he said, pay no attention to the leaven, which they thought, you know, was bread. But he was talking about the teaching of the Jewish leaders. Don't listen. Well, then Jesus had his famous interaction with Peter, where in response to Jesus' question, who do you say that I am? Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Which suggests to us that Peter was the first. Of all the disciples, Peter was the first to really recognize Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus commends Peter. He tells him, you're going to be instrumental in the life of the early church. You're going to be foundational in the formation of the early church. And in the very next section, Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me. Peter becomes the everyman of all Christian disciples everywhere. We are solid one minute, we are wavering the next. So I think this just continues to prove what we've been saying all along, that for the disciples, for all the disciples, Peter included, genuine, true, deep understanding about the person and nature of Jesus Christ was a gradual, revelatory process. Their level of understanding increased as time went on. They continued to waffle a little bit from time to time because they'd not yet arrived at total full understanding. Well, then Jesus explained to them that he must suffer many things, that he would be killed. He told them, he warned them, he tried to prepare them for what this would mean for them as well as himself. He said, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. So if you're a true Jesus follower, and Jesus suffered and died, then perhaps his followers ought to be prepared to do the same. That's what he was preparing them for. Now, I suppose we could try to rationalize that this carry your cross instruction was just intended for the disciples sitting around him at the time. But the truth is in the language. Jesus said, if anyone would come after me. That applied to those gathered there then. It continues to apply to any Jesus follower after that, including those of us seated here today. The carry your cross instruction or the warning still applies to all of us. But I suspect at the time, the language, the words he used, had an unsettling effect on the disciples. I think there were probably a number of discussions over the next few days. So, you know, as they're huddled together by the fire or something, you know, Jesus says he was going to suffer and die. And then he said, we probably ought to expect to do the same thing. What do you suppose that means? Was that one of their parables, you know, where he says one thing, but it really means something else? He said suffer and die, but maybe what he meant was, you're going to be really blessed beyond belief and receive extraordinary wealth. That's probably it. I don't know, man. It sounded like he meant really suffering and dying. I suspect they talked about it a little bit. I think it's interesting that none of that's recorded. Matthew doesn't spend any time writing any of that stuff down. So this is all just speculation on our part. But that's how Matthew 16 ends, with the cross-carrying speech. So they were left to ponder. They were left to try to figure out what he meant by this. But then Jesus added one more closing comment. He said, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Well, what does that mean? I mean, we're still a bit up in the air on this whole cross-carrying idea. And now we're going to die on a cross. We're not going to die before we see the Son coming into his kingdom. What does this mean? I suspect there's another discussion or two about that. But Matthew doesn't record any of that. But there's still this big, ominous idea hanging over the heads of all the disciples. They have to carry a cross, but some of them won't taste death until they... Who knows? What does this mean? I think they're getting the sense, though, that the Jesus is starting to say these things with a sense of urgency. It's starting to be a little more pointed. They know something is coming. But what does it mean? Well, Matthew 17 starts with, and after 6 days, let's just stop there for a minute. This is a heavy section. Let's talk about 6 days. This whole section, these eight verses, have been studied and analyzed and picked apart thousands and thousands of times over a couple thousand years. This section has raised literary, historical, and theological questions, most of which we're going to ignore because I think they get a little nitpicky and they're not altogether helpful. But for example, there's a fair amount written about why Matthew writes after 6 days. That's like the least controversial part of this whole thing. But there's a lot of discussion about that. It must be highly significant. I mean, why didn't Matthew write after about a week or so? But he wrote 6 days. It must mean something. So some suggest that the 6 days is a reference to that time between the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles. That lines up. All right, what does that mean? We don't know. Or it's a reference to the 6 days that Moses was up on the mountain and the cloud of the Lord was settled over Sinai. That was 6 days. Maybe it's connected to that. Okay, what does that mean? We don't know. But 6 days, it's like a Bible code. We have to crack it. Or perhaps it's a reference to the amount of time it took them to travel from Caesarea Philippi to Mount Hermon. Maybe it was just 6 travel days. That's the most likely explanation for it. We know they were in Caesarea Philippi. Mount Hermon was a few miles away. It's got an altitude of 9,500 feet. Although the mountain's never named in this section, it's most likely Mount Hermon, as Randy asserted and insisted that I agree with. But that's the most likely scenario. Okay, back to the story. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, Rise and have no fear. And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. So remember, end of 16, Jesus is providing for the disciples. He's giving them more in-depth information as to his purpose. He's going to suffer and die. And then he suggested that they should be prepared to follow him. And some of them would see the Son of Man coming into his kingdom. And then about a week later, 6 days to be exact, Jesus calls Peter, James, and John to accompany him on this trip up to the mountain, and they become witnesses to something completely unexpected, which was Jesus coming into his kingdom, or making it obvious that the kingdom was here anyway. I mean, you'll remember that John the Baptist had been preaching, Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And that seems to be what's playing out here. The witnesses are in place this time. And that last verse in chapter 16 seems to be a reference to this event, Jesus coming into his kingdom. And what they saw was Jesus transfigured before them. That Greek word is the same word where we get our word metamorphosis. It's this idea of significant transformation. So he was changed. He was transformed into something completely different. It was outwardly visible. You remember when Moses came down from the mountain, his face was shining. People couldn't look at him. They asked him to cover his face. So Peter, James, and John are here to witness, to experience, to better help them understand this big, big picture of Jesus. They had traveled up the mountain with Jesus the man, whom they likely regarded as the Messiah. But what they witnessed in this moment was a picture of the pre-incarnate member of the Godhead, Jesus. They were allowed to witness his true nature, the one who existed eternally before and would surely come again in all his glory. So Jesus' face shone like the sun, just like Moses. but also his clothes became white as light. I mean, I think the only picture, the only concept we can come up with is something like Jesus was glowing all over. He was radiant. I mean, this is something deeply meaningful and significant here. This had to be overwhelming for them in and of itself. But then they realize that Moses and Elijah have appeared alongside Jesus, talking with him. And although, again, Matthew doesn't discuss this at all, I found it amazing to think that Peter and the boys seemed to intuitively know that this was Moses and Elijah. How did they know? As far as we know, there were no prophet trading cards. You know, it had Moses' picture on the front and his miracle stats on the back. But in this moment, Peter, James, and John, they were given this spiritual insight to immediately know who these other men were. Now, just as a quick aside here, that, again, there's some difference of opinion on the exact location because the mountain's not mentioned. But Hermon, I think, makes the most sense in this context. It was the tallest mountain around. So as they worked their way up the mountain, it would have given them good cover. They would have had good privacy for this event. This was just for those three disciples. But I also think it makes sense in the Jesus point of view to stage an event like this in close proximity to what was the center of worship for Pan and Caesar. So Jesus shows the three witnesses here that he is the God above all other gods. That's as though he's reclaiming this territory. Just a thought. You can dispose of that if you like. So anyway, as jaw-dropping as this whole event was for them, good old shy Peter pipes up and says, Lord, it's just a real good thing that we're here. Good thinking on your part. Good plan to include us. You know, we can whip together some tents real quick here for the three of you if you'd like. Now, the word tents can also mean shelters or tabernacles. So it's hard to say for sure what Peter was thinking, what his frame of mind was, but it's likely he's just trying to find some way to memorialize this event. Or maybe he doesn't want it to end anytime soon, so if he makes them comfortable, you know, he's just being hospitable, maybe. We don't really know. But even in his overwhelmed, probably agitated state, Peter understood this was a significant moment. He had been the first to identify Jesus as the Messiah based on everything that had occurred up to that point, but this was an altogether different kind of proof. Jesus was glowing, and he's flanked on both sides by a couple of long-dead guys. This is huge. And standing here in front of the three witnesses was Moses, the giver of the law, Elijah, considered probably the greatest prophet of the Lord in the Old Testament, and Jesus, who is clearly now bridging this gap, symbolically appearing as the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. It's all embodied in him. So Peter's inclination towards prolonging or memorializing this moment wasn't bad, but that wasn't the plan. So as Peter is trying to coordinate the tent project, as he was still speaking, it says, a bright cloud overshadowed them and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased, listen to him." And that just put the witnesses over the edge. They heard this voice from the cloud. They fell on their faces. They were terrified. They understood that they were in the presence of Almighty God. Throughout the Old Testament, we've seen that pattern, right? Every time there's this encounter between God and man, people end up terrified, flat on their face. That's human reaction. Now, some commentators suggest that the voice of God cut off Peter's speech as kind of a rebuke to Peter. You're being silly. Let me just cut off what you're saying. Maybe not of what Peter was suggesting about the tents, but Peter just didn't yet fully understand what he was being made witness to. And I think that would be in line with what we've seen so far, right? It was a very measured process of understanding for all of the disciples. It took them a while to come into understanding. True understanding, disciples, which includes us, true understanding comes with time and experience and spiritual revelation. Can't explain for sure the reason or the timing involved in the Lord's voice cutting off Peter, other than, nope, Peter, that's not the plan. We don't have time for tents. So the disciples are trembling in fear that they're bowed down before the voice of God. And then Jesus came and touched them. He touched them. And I suspect he just very calmly said, rise, have no fear. So there is no sense of judgment. There is no hint of condemnation for Peter's foolhardy tent idea. There was understanding. There was compassion. And the three witnesses got up. They saw no one there but Jesus. Non-glowing, alone, regular man, Jesus. And everything was back to normal. Except that now the disciples knew more than ever that Jesus was not a regular man. Something was coming. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And the disciples asked him, then why did the scribes say that first Elijah must come? He answered, Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. So this is the fifth and last time that Jesus will tell the disciples to remain silent about what they've just witnessed. Jesus knows his time is coming to an end. He doesn't have to go out of his way to protect this information any longer. But the biggest proof of Jesus as Messiah is going to be his resurrection. So perhaps he doesn't want to muddy the waters here if this story were to leak out. I mean, it's enough that the three witnesses now can offer this as another proof after the resurrection. But leaking this story might also get people stirred up over their expectations for a political savior. Remember, after the feeding, one of the feeding stories, Jesus had to sneak away from the crowd because he knew that they were going to try to make him king. And that's not the plan. It's not time for that yet. So as he says, don't tell anyone yet, it raises a question for the three men. The disciples ask, basically, well, if you're the Messiah, oh, and we think you are, but if you're the Messiah, how do we answer the objections of non-believers, the scribes they mention, who say that you can't be the Messiah because Elijah has to come first, and he hasn't. Now, this just goes back to the tradition, the Jewish expectation of a Messiah, the process that leads up to that. It had been taught for a long time that Elijah was expected to appear. He was going to restore all things. He would return and bring about justice, and he would return real worship. So he was needed and necessary to pave the way for the true Messiah. So without Elijah, who hasn't been there yet, they're saying, Jesus couldn't be the Messiah. Well, Jesus' reply to them was interesting, I think. He didn't say, come on, guys. You're just being a bunch of idiots right now. Come on, guys. Have you not been paying attention? You know, your chronology is all wrong. Your theology is all wrong. I am the Messiah. I don't need no stinking Elijah. What he said was, the implication was, well, it's just your interpretation or your understanding of events that is incomplete. Elijah has come, but the scribes and religious leaders missed him. They didn't understand what they were seeing. They failed to recognize that a type of Elijah had come. Not Elijah himself, but a type of Elijah. And so they did to him whatever they pleased. And that's what they'll do to me when the time comes, whatever they please. It says, then the disciples understood that Jesus was referring to John the Baptist, that John the Baptist was a type of Elijah. Now, we've seen several stories up till this point where what Jesus explained to the disciples seemed pretty obvious, and they didn't get it. This is less obvious, but somehow they came to understand that he was talking about John the Baptist. And as they thought about this, I think as they, maybe they even discussed it, again, Matthew doesn't say this, But they began to think about the fact, well, John the Baptist was declaring the coming of the Lord. He prepared the way. John was preaching repentance. It was John who was given the task, who was given the honor of baptizing Jesus. That was the signal of the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And it was John who was ultimately beheaded. The authorities did with him whatever they wanted. So all those pieces started to come into place. And whether it was them reasoning it together, whether it was divine insight, which is what I suspect, the disciples realized that it was John who was the embodiment, the fulfillment of the role of Elijah. It didn't have to be Elijah himself. It was the role of Elijah that was significant. So John was one more proof of Jesus as Messiah. So for these three, Peter, James, and John, they came away from this side excursion understanding so much more than they knew before. They had seen Jesus transfigured. They had an image of him in his glory. He was flanked by Elijah and Moses. They now understood that he did fit the teaching and expectation of a Jewish Messiah, one that was preceded by Elijah or an Elijah-type character. This is all making so much more sense to them now. They had a lot to think about as they came down the mountain. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and, kneeling before him, said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him." And Jesus answered, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have a faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." So this is a story we're probably familiar with, or at least parts of it. Jesus and the three, Peter, James, and John, they've come down from the mountain. They're moving back into what is probably Caesarea Philippi. Pardon me. And a man in the crowd sees Jesus approaching, and he kneels down before him. The word "kneels" there has the implication of just recognizing authority. It's not like a position of worship. It's just recognizing there's something specific, something important about Jesus, and he refers to him as Lord. Just the name of a teacher or a rabbi kind of name. So the man then asked Jesus to heal his son from these apparently demon-caused seizures. But then the man adds on, "I need your help because the disciples were unable to heal him." And Jesus' first reaction is to express his frustration with the disciples. And this is presumably the other nine who'd been left behind. Right? The other three were with Jesus, and he refers to them as a faithless and twisted generation. In his frustration, they were a faithless and twisted generation. I suspect he's likely referring to what has been kind of the general pattern on display from the disciples. You know, they had, on one hand, they had exhibited a pattern of increasingly spiritual faith, increasing spiritual growth. And then on the other hand, they said things like, "Well, he's mad because we didn't bring any bread." They missed the point completely. Right? Their spiritual growth, their understanding was a two-step forward, one-step back, sometimes two steps back kind of process. Remember, they had been given the power and the authority to heal. They had healed. They had cast out demons. And yet here they were, unable to help this boy. They were faithless and twisted in this scenario. So we get the idea that Jesus is pretty exasperated. And I think the implication here, as we look through this, the implication is that in this instance, the disciples failed because they failed to recognize or draw on the source of their power. They relied on self. That's what got things twisted. It was essentially a willful disregard of all that they had been taught. I think they were relying on their own perceived power and authority. They had helped people. They had cast demons out. Surely they could do it again, they thought. Well, Jesus is away. That's okay. We got this. They were confident in their abilities. Perhaps they even at this point had a special prayer that they used. Maybe the power was in the prayer. Or maybe they had a process, a ritual that they developed up to that point. And they began to rely more on their process and their magic prayers than the object of their prayers. I think this is made clear when they asked Jesus why they couldn't heal the boy. And Jesus says, little faith. It's because of your little faith. We've heard this before on several occasions in regards to the disciples. Because of your little faith. Now, in truth, this is not about the relative size of faith as we tend to think of it. It's more about appropriately understanding the object of our faith. They'd lost sight of the source, the reason, the object for faith. They're relying more on their own ability to accomplish the task. I mean, they'd done it before, and they were pretty sure they could do it again, so they just went about their routine, and they failed. Rather than relying on the source of the authority and power that they had been given, rather than calling on the giver of gifts, rather than resorting to the one who is the ultimate healer, their faith in this moment was on their own ability and their own track record. In Mark's version of this event, Mark quotes Jesus as saying, "This kind can only come out by prayer." Which indicates maybe the disciples missed this step. Maybe they forgot to appeal to the source of power and authority. They were relying on their own power and performance. It wasn't that they had no faith. It was that their faith was misplaced. So Jesus, I think, makes it clear when he says, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed. So it's not about the size of faith as we tend to think of it. If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could move mountains. Nothing would be impossible for you. So it's not a size issue of faith. It's an issue of the object of faith. It's understanding the source of the power and authority that we have. If you have even a small amount of faith, but in the right person. The disciples got caught up in their own righteousness and forgot the source of all righteousness. And it made me wonder, how often does this describe us? Far too often, I'm inclined to think. And maybe this is one of those three fingers, you know, one out, three back. But I suspect this is not uncommon. We kind of get into our spiritual, you know, patterns of life, and we get a pretty comfortable, reasonable life of faith going. We read our Bible regularly. We pray regularly. We attend church regularly. And things are going okay. I mean, life ain't great. But we feel like we have a decent handle on things. And then at some point, the longer that things go okay, the longer that things go reasonably well, we kind of start to take our foot off the gas, spiritually speaking, just a little bit. I mean, an issue comes up that requires a difficult decision that we have to make, or maybe we don't pray about it because we feel like we're pretty competent to make this decision. We're righteous. We're pretty spiritually grounded. Things are going well, so maybe we don't pray quite as much as we used to. Our reading schedule falls off a little bit. You know, just the busyness of life takes over, and hey, we're doing pretty good, right? We're pretty spiritually grounded. We're pretty confident faith-wise, and then tragedy strikes. Life hits us hard, and we realize perhaps that our faith was based more on our feelings of faith. At some point, we had distance, we had lost contact with the source of power and the one we were to have faith in. We realize that Jesus has remained pretty constant, but we're the one that's kind of drifted away. And on our own power, left to our own spiritual devices, we are ill-prepared to deal with life. I think what the disciples experience here is pretty common experience for all of us at some point. Which is why Jesus says the whole generation, not just the disciples, the whole generation can be faithless and twisted at times. We lose sight. We lose touch. I think the writer in Proverbs identified this tendency of ours a long time ago. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. when we fail to do the first part, we really mess up the last part. With trust in the Lord, just a little bit of faith in the right thing, the mustard seed faith can move mountains. Reliance on self will come up short every time. So this is a rebuke that comes with a pretty amazing promise. Keep building your faith on the source of power and authority. Keep trusting in the Lord, and nothing will be impossible for you. That's not bad. I think it's ironic that these verses have been twisted and abused by various faith healers and new apostles and prosperity gospel crowd. And they actually use this to teach the opposite of what the intent is. And those teachers, those leaders are more about their own performance and relying on their own acts, their own magical prayers and powers to heal. Their focus is ultimately not on pointing to the source, but it's keeping the spotlight on themselves, building their ministry, selling their books. So we need to be aware. We need to keep our trust in the Lord. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. So there must be a little bit of a time lapse here between the last section and this one. However much time it took probably to get from Mount Hermon, Caesarea Philippi, down into the region of Galilee. And probably, this has kind of been the center of ministry, probably back down here in the area of Capernaum. We don't know for sure yet, but they're moving back down this way. The distance between Caesarea Philippi and Capernaum is 27 miles or so, but this southward move now, it marks the end of Jesus' ministry in the north. From this point on, he continues to move south towards Jerusalem. He knows what's coming. He's preparing the disciples for what is coming. And this section, I think, is pretty straightforward. Jesus isn't pulling any punches here. He lays it out for them. He says he'll be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. Now, the phrase delivered into can mean something like just handed over, or it might mean something like betrayed and handed over. And really, the only way to tell is in context. So if this is all Matthew has written here, what we have in this text, if this is all Matthew has said, it's hard to tell what the context is. So the disciples, I think, are again left to wonder, is Jesus going to be handed over, or is he going to be betrayed and handed over? Does that mean one of us is going to be a betrayer? Surely not. It can't be one of us. He also says he'll be killed and that he would be raised on the third day. So there's a lot here for the disciples to discuss, to cogitate on, to worry about. Would one of them be a betrayer? Would Jesus actually be killed? And what does it mean he'll be raised on the third day? They were greatly distressed. We've been talking about their gradual process of understanding. I still think it's unlikely at this point that they had any capacity to understand what the third day comment meant. But there is enough in the other statements for them to worry about, to grieve over, and contemplate. This continues on their journey. So when they came to Capernaum, now we know that he was heading that direction, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" Peter said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." Okay, this is weird. But here we are. We know they're moving back into the area of Galilee, into Capernaum. And then we get this kind of weird, unusual scene described. And Matthew's the only place that records this story, which just kind of adds to its uniqueness. But as Jesus and the 12 come into town, a tax collector approaches Peter and says, "Doesn't your teacher pay the tax?" And Peter said, "Yes." Although we kind of get a sense here that Peter's, maybe his reply was a little defensive. He's defending Jesus' reputation, maybe. It's hard to tell for sure. The tax in question was likely a tax that was levied on every Jewish male between the ages of 20 and 50. And it was allegedly used to support the temple and all the temple services that went on. Way back in Exodus describes a temple tax of half a shekel, which equates to roughly the 2 drachma tax that we see here. So it's probably a continuation of that same thing. So it was a Jewish tax, wasn't for the Romans at all, but every Jewish male was expected to pay. So when asked if Jesus paid the tax, Peter said yes. Did Peter know for sure? Was he just making stuff up? Was he defending Jesus' honor? Hard to say for sure. But that was his answer. And as he goes inside, Jesus somehow knew what had happened. Peter was outside answering the question. Jesus is inside. So did Jesus hear the conversation, or did he just know that this is what had happened? And before Peter could speak, Jesus spoke first. And he says, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or others?" And Peter said, "Well, from others." Now, Jesus is making something of a political point here, but it's really more a statement about power and authority. Generally speaking, the family of a king, the offspring of a king, is afforded more luxuries. The offspring of a king, they have more benefits than the local peasantry. It's the working force that pays the taxes, right? It's the kings and their family that get to enjoy the benefit of the taxes. That's the way power tends to work. I mean, without being overly political here, we've seen in our last 2 administrations charges that the offspring of the president are allowed special privilege. I mean, for no other reason that they are sons or daughters of the president. I mean, even the charge that taxes have gone unpaid, we've seen that here in the last few years. So we have some idea there's truth to what Jesus is talking about. The sons of the kings have special privilege that the rest of us don't have. But the big picture here, I think the larger point is this. Jesus is saying, if this is a temple tax that we're being asked about, and the temple exists to honor and worship God, and Jesus is the Son of God, then using the same measure as the sons of the kings of the earth, who are often exempt, then Jesus must be exempt from the temple tax. Do you follow that? That's the logic behind the statement. He's making this kind of equivalency argument. But what he's also doing is making a very Christological statement. This is all about him being Christ. He is implying, inferring, suggesting, hinting that he is the Son of God. If the temple is there to honor God, Jesus is not obligated to pay the tax. He's the Son of God. Now, this is it's a bit veiled, but it's a bold statement Jesus is making. But then he adds, however, I am the Son of God. I don't have to pay this tax. However, not to give offense to them, the tax collectors and those who are asking, there's probably a crowd following them around at this point, all the people who heard this, so as not to offend them, see, it's coming. Whoever they may be, and I kind of feel like we need to read between the lines here a little bit. I don't think Jesus is all that concerned about offending the temple leaders. I don't think he cares that the Pharisees and Sadducees are mad that he doesn't pay the tax. I think his concern is with the people, the other taxpayers, the regular old Jews who may have been standing around and hearing this exchange. He doesn't want to offend or confuse them. And perhaps more importantly, while the disciples know that Jesus is the Son of God, and they're increasingly knowing that, it's not yet common knowledge. Not everybody believes that. This is not a common understanding yet. There will come a time when this becomes clear, like at the resurrection, but that time is not yet. So let's not offend people. Let's not create confusion. Rather than create a situation, a scene over what is essentially a meaningless situation, so as not to offend the people and jeopardize the mission, let's just pay the tax. But let's pay the tax in a way that affirms that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah, the tax exempt. So he tells Peter to go to the sea, cast a hook, and the fish that you catch will have a coin in its mouth. Use that to pay the tax. This is the only mention in Scripture of fishing with a hook. Every other reference is to nets, casting hundreds of fish. This is the only one with a hook. Why a hook? I don't know, except that it adds to the miraculous nature of this event. I mean, it wasn't unheard of for fishermen every now and again to find a fish with a coin or some other thing in its mouth. It wasn't unheard of. And in a net full of fish, hundreds of fish, the odds are increased that you'll find a fish with something in its mouth. But to catch one fish on one hook and find a coin in its mouth, statistically improbable. Miraculous. So the context is, Jesus has just shared with his disciples for the first time that he's going to be betrayed and killed and he'll rise again on the third day. He refers to himself as Son of the King Most High, the one for whom temples are erected. So he is the Christ, he's the Messiah, and he closes out this section with this very small miracle. I mean, it's not like feeding 5,000 with a couple fish or feeding 4,000 with a couple fish. It's not like healing people from afar. But this little thing, this statistically improbable and unlikely miracle, is kind of an exclamation point at the end of this section. And all of these things, the statements Jesus has made, the teachings, the many miracles, they're all slowly chipping away at the remnants of doubt among the disciples. This is all part of their progressive understanding and their increasing devotion to Jesus. But I think it's important that we also not miss the fact that Jesus said, then the sons are free. Plural. The sons are free. So Jesus, as son of the king, he's exempt from the temple tax. But he seems to extend that freedom to all the sons of the king. Then he told Peter to go out and find that fish, and that shekel was enough to pay for both Jesus and Peter. So Peter is now included in the exempt status. I think the implication is, as followers of Christ, we're all sons and daughters of the King. We have special privileges. We have special honors as a result. And yet, as Jesus shows us here, so as not to offend, we don't demand royal treatment. Our time will come. But here, we don't demand royal treatment. I mean, I think there's a whole sermon series that could be developed here and what the implications are of this little statement. Do we as Christians, do we demand our spiritual birthright in the midst of a pagan culture? Where do we plant our flag on cultural political issues? To what extent do we engage politically so that we don't seem to promote a candidate more than our king? See, all these things start to get wrapped up in how we live this out. These are issues that we all have to deal with on a pretty regular basis. How do we conduct ourselves in such a way that we glorify God, we serve Jesus our King, we rejoice in our status as sons and daughters of the kingdom, but we also seek to avoid offending those around us when possible? There may be times when it's not possible. But is that our default? To try to avoid offense? There's a lot here for us to consider. So we're going to take a short break and then we'll come back for the next hour. I'm just kidding. There's a lot here for us to consider. So I hope this becomes an ongoing prayer for us all. What does it look like to live in this culture, in this time, in this place, and live as sons and daughters of the King in a way that doesn't offend people around us unnecessarily? Sharing the truth may be offensive, but we don't have to go out of our way to be offensive. What does that balance look like? It's a hard thing. A great place to start is trusting in the Lord with all our heart, acknowledging that Jesus is our King, and let him direct our path. I hope that's our path forward. Let's pray.